Poker Podcast listeners, thank you for listening. Good morning, Nate Mavis.
Good morning.
How are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm very excited. I feel like my road to the World Series of Poker begins today. I'm currently at my mother's house outside of Baltimore, Maryland, but my girlfriend and I will be leaving later today for a cross-country road trip that will culminate, for me anyway, in Las Vegas. And I'll be playing my first full summer World Series of Poker. It's a pretty exciting time for me.
So quite literally the road to the World Series of Poker.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, very good. It's like the last scene of Rounders, but the first scene of this movie.
And I'm not walking out on my girlfriend to go play the World Series of Poker.
Yeah, it's true. You're not a degenerate. really a lot of differences. But, you know, maybe there's $8 million.
I'm somewhat better looking than Matt Damon.
Better groomed facial hair, for example. you didn't pay off Teddy KGB in an obviously bad spot. So that's you got a lot of advantages over him. So you're out there in time for the first weekend?
I might actually be getting there one or two days after the very beginning of things, just kind of based on the way it shakes out right now. My girlfriend and I are going to go to Mesa Verde before I travel into Las Vegas. She's actually going to be working in Austin, Texas this summer. So the end point for her is different than the end point for me. But she was going to go to Mesa Verde, and I decided I wanted to go with her. So I think I might be getting to Vegas a day or two later than I was initially thinking. So I will still be there for the first weekend, I guess, but not for the opening couple of tournaments, it looks like.
Well, if you're there for the first weekend, that's one of my favorite times. It's just absolutely electric.
Yeah,
you know, everybody's got full pockets and a lot of energy, so
that's what I'm hoping for. Yeah,
a lot of happy people. I also have exciting Las Vegas news. I will be getting out on July 4th, and Priceline has put me in the Palms for the first night. And you know what's really exciting about the Palms? Besides being across the street from the Rio, they have a promotion where if you're from out of town, they give you a complicated, they say it's a $1,000 rebate if you lose up to $1,000 in your first day of having a player's card. Actually, it's only worth like half that because you get it in promotional chips, but it's still a plus EV proposition. So I'm yet another reason to brush up on video poker.
Wow. Where do you find out about this stuff?
Oh, the Las Vegas Lifestyle Forum, the wizardofodds.com. You know, it's floating around the nittier parts of 2+2 in the internet. All Vegas Poker might have had a little bit of this information. But yeah, right now I think the Cosmo is dead. I can't do the Cosmo because I did that last year, or the Trop, but the Palms also. So, you know, it's a one-time thing, but there's bonus hunting to be done. And if you want some free money, and especially if you're going to be there for at least a week.
This week, we are still reading Mental Game of Poker 2 by Jared Tendler, who, thanks to him for coming on the show last week, led to some pretty interesting stuff that'll inform the way we can talk about chapters this week. This week, we are reading chapters 3 and 4, which deal with learning and with decision making. I like the learning chapter. Well, I don't know, I guess I like the overall approach of both chapters anyway, or the motivating idea behind both chapters. I think the learning chapter is just an interesting idea that learning is something you should be thinking explicitly about, that a lot of people just tend to think like, well, if I play a lot or if I watch a lot of videos, I'm bound to absorb some information. And I mean, that is true, but I think there are ways that you can learn a lot better and a lot more efficiently. If you think back to the way you did things in school, and I realize a lot of people are probably excited to be out of school, and maybe you got into poker because you didn't want to have to worry too much about school. But there are reasons why your teachers, who were, after all, professional educators, were teaching you things in the way that they were. You know, education and learning are things that have been studied pretty extensively, that we do have better than random ideas about how learning happens. And doing things like focusing on specific skills, learning certain skills in a certain order, evaluating your progress as you go along, those kinds of things are proven to improve the rate at which you learn and your ability to retain information. And so I think it's the idea behind this chapter of trying to be more explicit about the way learning happens is a good one, and something that a lot of poker players would do well to take more seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is something that was very important to me when it was still part of my job to teach undergraduates, is somehow taking people out of the mode that if they sit and listen to somebody talk for a while that they were just automatically going to learn things. And one thing I always tried to do as a teacher as much as possible is keep things, you know, sort of concrete and specific in such a way that, like, if you ask them, what did you learn today, they could produce something, you know? You know, if you have two people who came from a talk and one person said, oh, I just heard a talk about X, that's a good sign that they didn't learn a whole lot from the talk. Like, it's like, you know, I've been marinating in somebody's talk about X for a while. Like, usually that doesn't stick very well. And whenever possible, I always tried to give people something to latch onto, or, you know, whereas if somebody told them, like, specifically, why do you know more now than you did before you set foot in the classroom? You hope they can answer that. And that's something I always try to set up for myself. You know, I try not to read about things. I try to read in such a way that I'm specifically focusing on something and, you know, quizzing myself as I go along. Yeah, I approve of Tendler's general attitude here.
Have you heard the term the bucket theory of education? It's sort of an oft ridiculed, it's just kind of held up as a generally agreed upon bad thing that teachers want to avoid, which is the idea that the teacher is just kind of like a font of knowledge and the students are just empty buckets, and the idea is just for the teacher to sort of pour out knowledge that fills up the students along the way, or sometimes it's called kind of like a passive transfer of knowledge. It's simply the teacher transfers knowledge to the student rather than helping along students or guiding them in an active learning process. And that, I mean, I think at this point, at least in American education, it's pretty widely accepted that that's not the way to do it. There may not always be clear agreement on what is the way to do it, but everything I've seen from schools is just sort of like accepted, or everyone kind of knows that that's bad, even if they don't always know how to avoid it. It's kind of accepted that they oughtn't be doing that. And I think that that's very much the way your average poker video is set up, even from some, maybe especially from some of the very best players. It's just the sort of idea that, like, I'm going to get on here and I'm going to say a bunch of really smart things. Like, I'm just going to sit down and record myself playing and say a bunch of stuff about what I'm thinking, and you can, you know, feel privileged to bask in my knowledge and to absorb some of that information. And I think that the most helpful poker videos, I mean, the thing that I strive for in my videos and the videos that I find most helpful to me, are when there is more of an active thought of, you know, what should the person watching this video be doing and thinking about while he or she is watching the video, rather than just like, I'm going to sit down and record whatever pops into my brain while I'm playing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's one reason why it's such good form, if you're posting in a forum or something, to try to say what, not only what you would do, but what the top and the bottom of your range is for doing that thing that you're going to do. Yep. Anything to sort of get you out of the this looks like a calling spot, yeah, probably call here. Yeah, anything you can do to, you know, what is this? What feature of the situation could you change that would make your decision different? Well, if you're doing the, you know, if this is true, then why aren't you raising, for example?
Yeah, he actually has a section in here. It's just kind of a small subtopic called Make Small Stuff Big, which was actually one of my favorite sections from this reading. And the central point of it is that you don't want to focus just on the large pots or the pots where a large amount of money transferred from one player to another. Those aren't always where the most important decisions take place, or the decisions that you can stand to learn the most from. And the example you just gave, Nate, of thinking about, like, what would the bottom of my range be? What would the top of my range be in this kind of spot? He gives a bunch of suggestions here. So he'll say, for instance, you can look at hands that seem to be unique, or you can think about, you know, what if I'd been in my opponent's shoes, rather than just looking at how did I play these two cards that I had in this spot. You can think about, well, how did my opponent play his cards? Would I have done what he did? Is there something I could have done even better against the hand that he had? Or, you know, switch up your cards and think about, what would I have done? What would the top of my range be? What would the bottom of my range be? What would I do with a very different type of hand? You know, what if instead of like a very kind of static made hand, like second pair top kicker or whatever you turned out to have, what if instead I had a very dynamic drawing hand, like an open-ended straight flush draw? You know, how would I have played it differently in that spot? I think that's one of the best things, you know, rather than just trying to analyze one spot in a vacuum, because, you know, really that exact spot is not going to come up again. Like, the point of reviewing a hand that you played is not to figure out what you should have done in that spot. The point is to figure out, why is this spot a spot that strikes you as a difficult one? Why did you have difficulty determining what the right play is? And what can you learn from this spot that's generalizable to other similar situations?
Totally agreed. I think the other big thing to resist or to work on is when you're tempted to find like a sort of safety valve or some sort of out to the question that turns it from a hard question to an easy question. It's like, oh, this is such a tough spot. Well, there's there's probably a good cash game across the room, so it doesn't matter if I bust for this tournament very much, so that makes it easier. Or, oh, this guy's probably not such a tough player, so his range isn't like that at all, or anything like that. You know, this is another thing you see on forums or in discussions and all that, is people are desperate to turn hard questions into easy questions in illegitimate ways.
Yeah.
Just much happier leaving the hard question behind, even if there is something, like, even if there is a good cash game across the room, then just pretend there isn't and solve the hard question. You know, that's how you're going to get better. You know, over the table, turning hard questions into easy ones legitimately is a great way to play really well. Away from the table, confronting hard questions as hard questions, that's what you want to be doing.
Yeah, the one that tilts me the most is the I'm not good enough to fold X here, where X is simply a description of the absolute value of your hand. Like, I'm not good enough to fold queens here. I'm not good enough to fold a full house here. And it really is just a refusal to engage with the problem at all. And it's like, well, how do you think you're going to become good enough to do those things? You know, yeah. Like, you know, like, and I guess it's especially tilting to me because I go out of my way to try to post these spots where, you know, on a forum or on my blog or something, I'll try to post a spot where, like, yeah, of course I'm not routinely going around folding kings pre-flop or folding full houses. But I think it's interesting to look at the spots where I'm actually capable of at least considering those things, even if I don't end up doing them. When I think in retrospect, that actually might have been a foldable hand. You know, that's a spot that I feel like I can learn from and that other people can learn from. So when I write up like a long either blog post or post on a forum or something about the whole situation and why I think it might be foldable, and then somebody responds with a one line like, I'm not good enough to fold a full house. Like, it's just like kind of ignoring everything that just went into that.
I refuse to think about this question.
Yeah, the way you put it about wanting to just avoid thinking about a spot in a complicated way, or just try to say like, oh, well, it's just a cooler if he has a better full house. I mean, there's a difference between a cooler and just a cooler. Pretty much the advancement of poker skill is about shrinking the number of situations that count as coolers for you, where you can put your opponent on a more and more narrow range where you're actually capable of either getting away from or not playing as big of a pot with a hand that he or many other players would have played a big pot with in your shoes. That's pretty much what it means to get better at poker, is just to be able to make better and better decisions so that you're not thinking so broadly just in terms of like, when I have a pretty good hand, I don't fold it very often. When I have a weak hand, I pretty much always fold it. Being able to make more precise decisions is what getting better as a player is about.
Absolutely. It's funny because I have my own little learning project before the main event this year, and that's to get better in 3-bet pots, because there was a time when I could just make my living in single raise pots that are my bread and butter. And, you know, I know how to work on shoving and reshoving ranges. Like, I think I know when I'm down to 20, 30, 40 big blinds, how I should be getting my money in before the flop. And then when we're deeper, I'm happy playing these single raise pots. I can't just do that anymore and try to avoid being in 3-bet pots at all for a lot of reasons. So that's, this is my own like learning project, is to get more comfortable playing, you know, playing out of position on the flop in a 3-bet pot, 3-betting with some hands that I would just be calling now, doing things like that. And it's tricky. That's my own like learning thing over the next 6 months here. So I'm going to start with Matt Janda has a new book, and I'm going to go through Mathematics of Poker. And then I'm just going to try to solidify that part of my game.
I mean, I would say that's one of the like central points of Tendler on Poker, or what we have of Tendler on Poker so far, is not trying to do everything at once. Having a very specific idea of these are the things that I'm working on. I think, you know, this is what he would call the conscious incompetence, things that you know are a problem for you that you need to develop as a skill. And it's also like the front of the inchworm. And he's pretty clear that in his mind, it's a mistake to try to have too many things in that place at once. If you have too many things in the, too many pots on the stove, so to speak, you're going to end up not learning any of them very well and not executing very well on any of them at the table.
I think so. When I look back at the spots that I played weakly or poorly in previous years, a lot of those involved either not wanting to get involved in a 3-bet pot or just getting lost. I think like the phrase, I got lost in the hand, happens most often to me in a 3 or 4-bet pot. Mm-hmm. So generally, I just try not to make any huge theoretical mistakes and go from there, and I think I could be doing better. So watch out, world. I'm going to be really ready to call your 3-bets in all the right spots.
Sneak preview. Our strategy hand today is about a 3-bet.
What do you think of the stuff about repetitions?
I don't think it's the strongest part of the chapter.
Yeah, I didn't like it so much either, and I think it's for an interesting reason. That's more just me disliking something, and I think this gets to an interesting disagreement between Jared and me. So Jared has this view that if you're trying to learn a new skill, you should try to get up to a certain amount of total practicing of the skill, but not all kinds of practicing it are created equal. So, you know, instantiating it in a game is worth more than just thinking about it, and doing it in a tough game can be worth two or three times as much as doing it in an easy game. At first, it's not clear to me that it's additive or cumulative like that, and actually a lot of practice seems counterproductive to me, and a lot of thinking seems actually much more productive than doing something at a table sometimes. But I also think that it's just wrong that doing something in a tough game makes for a better learning experience generally than doing it in a weak game. I think one thing that makes tough players tough and tough games tough is that you don't really know exactly what they're doing, and you don't know exactly what their ranges are, and you know there's a lot of information that's hidden. So to use that as sort of an inductive based or as a way to learn about it for the future seems a bit mistaken to me.
Yeah, it's really hard to get reliable feedback. I mean, just in poker generally. I mean, you really can't, certainly you can't base it on whether or not you win or lose the pot. I think most people get that, right? That bad beats happen. So like just because you lost the pot doesn't mean you made a mistake. But you will see that from real beginners in poker. You know, they'll be like, well, I got it in with kings versus ace queen and he hit an ace. What did I do wrong? That is a question that you see people, you know, ask in earnest from time to time.
And forget beginners, I think I still make this mistake as hard as I try not to make it. You know, winning $1,000 is pretty powerful feedback, right? It's very hard to separate that reward you get from your judgments about things.
Yeah, that's true. But then, I mean, even more so, like just because you got your money in good doesn't mean that you necessarily played the hand well. And just because you got your money in bad doesn't mean that you didn't. You know, like you might have been unlucky to run into the top of his range in a spot. You know, like generally, we were just talking about coolers. But generally, if you get kings versus aces in pre-flop, you probably didn't make a mistake. You're probably just unlucky to run kings and aces. So even though you got your money in very bad, that doesn't necessarily indicate a mistake. So, you know, you're talking about when you're playing against difficult players, just because they fold your bluff doesn't mean it was a good bluff. Just because you called and were correct doesn't mean that it was a good call. Just because you called and were wrong doesn't mean that it was a bad call. And those kinds of things are a lot harder by definition to figure out against tough players than against weaker players.
And just to take it to the next level, your opponent might actually be winning in a spot against you, even range against range. He could have you beaten in a spot, but in a way that arises from a certain conceptual understanding of the game, where you're going to be beating him in all these other spots. You know, like just to take a cartoon example of this, something like a field player, take like an extreme cartoon forum caricature of Phil Hellmuth, who's obviously getting crushed in some of these eight big blind spots, right? Where he limp folds, you know, like queen seven for eight big blinds or something crazy. But he's doing that because of a certain competence he has that's causing him to have all these other, you know, to understand all these other situations really well. Or take a sort of cartoon version of me who's losing in three bet spots because he's doing other things to make his ranges in other spots better, that over the whole course of his life is going to end up with him coming out ahead. So I think, you know, it's just so hard to figure out where the money's actually coming from.
Yeah, I think you want to do your learning in softer games and your, I mean, even the testing though, because he kind of makes that distinction between like while you're playing isn't the time to learn. You know, you learn away from the table and then you test at the table. But I think the point you're making, which is right, is that even testing is hard to do in a tough game because you're not getting to take literally the test example, like you're not getting back a graded test that says you were correct here and incorrect there. You know, you don't get that feedback.
It's almost better to reverse that, I think, is to learn at the table then test it away from the table with theory. You know, I think that's the traditional model that a lot of players have advocated. Like you get experience, you form conjectures, like you have a certain understanding of the game, and you also have a bag of tricks that works in certain situations. Play for a while, you form conjectures about other things that you could do that might work. And we're perceptually limited creatures, so we're not going to look at something 25,000 times in one night. What you do is you go home and you put pencil to paper and you figure out if that's actually a good strategy, and then you...
Yeah, poker's a rare case where it's actually easier to confirm things in theory than it is in practice.
Yes.
Okay, so the next one on here, the decision-making chapter, I think is similar in a lot of ways, and I like it for some of the same reasons, or I like the driving idea behind it, which is that you also need to be explicit about your decision-making process, and when errors occur in your decision-making process, it's not sufficient just to say, like, whoops, should have thought about that, you know, maybe I'll do it, maybe I'll pay more attention to that thing next time. But the real goal is to get to the bottom of why didn't you pay attention to it this time? I mean, if you know that thinking about your opponent opponent's range is important, but you didn't do it. It's probably not going to be sufficient just for you to like acknowledge again that it's important. You need to understand what happened in this situation that led to you not taking into account a piece of information that you know to be important and that you know you should have taken into account. Whether it has to do with mental game type issues, like you were tired or you were overwhelmed by the game, or it was a certain situation where so much was going on that your brain kind of shut down, or you were trying to think of too many things at once. And that I think is one of the more helpful, or for me anyway, one of the more helpful sections of this chapter. He talks about the idea of working or short-term memory, which is the number of things that you are really actively considering at a time. And this is why the shift from conscious competence to unconscious competence is so important, because the conscious competence are the things that you have to actively be thinking about to do them well. And because you can only actively think about so many things at once, it's important to be moving things from conscious competence to unconscious competence, where you can do them well without even having to waste that. I mean, it's kind of like RAM for a computer, like without having to waste that space processing those things. You want that processing to be taking place in the background so that you can be more focused on processing other things. So you can get to the point where recognizing an opponent's range comes to you almost second nature, at least in very common spots. And so you don't have to spend a lot of time thinking about like, he raised under the gun. What could his range be? Like, you just instantly have an idea when a guy raises under the gun, you just instantly have an idea of roughly what that range might look like. And then you can start thinking about all the other factors, like how deep are the stacks? What kind of stuff might I be able to do with the hand that I have, given roughly the range that I'm expecting him to have? When you're no longer wasting bandwidth on that one point, then you can be working on other things.
Yeah, I think that's right. And also, of course, having a richer conceptual scheme helps here, where you can encode more information per thought. Say you can only keep 6 thoughts in your mind. If your conceptual scheme is such that the information per thought is high, then you can effectively keep more information in your short-term memory. A humorous example of this, perhaps, is I was playing with a woman once who played almost every hand and then folded one out of the blue, really. And she turned to me and she said, well, my big card was okay, but my little card was really bad. And I think she had folded Jack 3 offsuit or something like that. Yeah, that is, you know, imagine if you were taking up 2 different spots in your short-term memory, keeping track of your big card and your little card.
The one line from this section that I flagged as noteworthy is when he says, you want your decision-making ability to be on the same level as your tactical knowledge. And he goes on to explain what exactly he means by that, which is that you don't want to be trying to take into account factors that you don't really understand. And the example that I think of a lot of this is when you'll see I have some relatives who will watch poker on TV, but have a very superficial understanding of the game, just kind of know the rules and a very rough idea of what constitutes a good hand, and that's about it. So they'll watch poker on TV and they'll be like, I don't get it. There's all these, you know, people are making crazy plays and going all in with bad hands. And they have a sense that these are very good poker players. It's not like they think that those poker players are bad, but they don't know how to use that. They're just like, well, I saw a guy, you know, raise with King 7, so now I play King 7 or something like that. Just where your tactical knowledge is limited, you can't, and you don't understand why people are playing those hands, you can't be trying to factor that into your decision making.
Or the point that it sounds like you're trying to make is, you know, you get better at poker in part by doing induction. You have a certain base class of things that you observe or facts that you think are true. And then from there, you infer a lot of things about what you ought to do in the future and about which other things are also correct. But induction is tricky. Like, you know, you can't just say, oh, King 7 is a good hand to play here, so it's a good hand to play all the time in any situation. And that's a cartoon example, but actually getting it right is very tricky. And what you need is a certain kind of accurate, enriched conceptual scheme for induction, correct induction, to even be possible. I like Jared's idea that we can separately but relatedly work on our decision-making ability and our tactical knowledge. I mean, certainly I think I've gotten better at just the process of making decisions at poker table. Something as simple as remember to think about what happened pre-flop. Like, I can remember sitting in my apartment in 2009 or whatever, or 2008, and thinking like, boy, you know, like 3 times last session I made a bad decision, and if I'd really thought carefully about what had happened 4 minutes ago before the flop, maybe that would have been different. And it's the stupidest kind of thing. I feel like an idiot for admitting to this publicly, but you know, like it's something, you know, I could solve poker problems all day. And, you know, okay, take a deep breath. What happened before the flop? What happened on the flop? What happened on the turn? And how does all that information work together? And then taking into account negative information. This is something that I still see people neglecting a lot. Oh, he called on the flop. He didn't raise on the flop. You know, a lot of people, that means that he absolutely doesn't have a flush draw. It means that he absolutely doesn't have all sorts of things. What he did is one thing, but what he didn't do is another thing that I think people can keep in mind more. So just your decision-making ability is something that you can train, that you can work on, that you can judge and evaluate and improve independently of your theoretical knowledge.
Something I see a lot in that regard is I'll ask somebody, like someone I'm coaching, what do you think this guy's range is here? And maybe it's a loose player who's called a raise pre-flop. And he'll say, I don't know, this guy's really loose. I mean, he could have almost anything. I don't know, he might be calling like 40% of hands or something. So I can't really break it down that much. And that's largely true. I mean, I don't think you could try to list all the combos you get. Even to say generically, like, well, you could have pocket pairs and suited connectors and Broadway hands and offsuit this and you know, suited three gappers. But the one important bit of information that I think you can conclude is he probably doesn't have aces, kings, queens, or ace king, because he would have three bet those hands in this spot. And even if you can say not very much else useful about his range, just recognizing that you can shave off those top couple of hands makes a huge difference. If you have a pocket queens yourself, or you have ace queen yourself, you know if you flop an over pair, the likelihood of that hand being good goes way up just as a result of being able to exclude aces and kings from your opponent's range. Then the queens as an over pair, you only have to worry about flopped sets. You don't have to worry about higher over pairs.
Yeah, I mean, forget ace king. If you have ace 10, it makes a huge difference whether he can have ace king when the flop comes ace high. Like, how good. This was also important in the last What's Your Play that you posted on thinkingpoker.net, the wildly popular What's Your Play. I mean, I think it's very important to that hand that guy in the blinds probably does not have a flush draw. Basically, Andrew raised, and then he bet the flop and he bet the turn, and we were wondering whether to value bet the river. And it's really important to the hand that he probably can't have a flush draw on the river, just because it was either something that would have raised the flop or it was something that couldn't check call twice. And Andrew really priced those out, and people make bad calls sometimes, but really this guy was not sticking around with a queen high flush draw almost ever. And I think that was something that a lot of people missed.
Yeah, and it's funny because I remember you posting like, this seems like a really straightforward spot. I'm not sure why you're posting it or something like that. And I mean, for me, it was a pretty straightforward spot. Like, I didn't think it was a complicated decision whether or not to bet, but I did have in my mind that this was a place where I thought a lot of people would mistakenly not bet. And sure enough, although a part of it was due to your compulsive comment responding, this one did get, I think, more replies than any other What's Your Play that I've posted. And it certainly was not a clear consensus of, well, you definitely should have bet here. You know, why are we even talking about this? There were quite a few people who, even after my posting my thoughts and the results, which did result in me being called by a better hand than mine, were still not clear on why I bet.
Yeah, you had one that was off the charts. I think that's the second most popular What's Your Play ever. I think there was one about 6 months ago that just went bonkers. And it also involved me responding a lot, I think. But yeah, I think, I didn't mean to say like, oh, the spot's so easy. Why is Andrew even posting this? I did suspect that there might be a trick up your sleeve, because it really looked like my first instinct was this is a betting spot. As I thought through the hand, that was only confirmed. And I thought that maybe you had some clever reasoning that you ought to be checking or overbetting or underbetting or something like that. You know, like the bet size is something that I was less confident about.
Well, I've got to balance my posting range. I can't only post hands that have tricky, sneaky answers. So people are always just look for what's the tricky, sneaky answer.
Yeah. It's a question that we get sometimes, I think. I think both of us separately and questions to the podcast is, how do you beat the games now that everything's dried up? You know, like it's not the boom era anymore. It's not the party era anymore. You know, what do I do to get an edge in this, post 9/11 world, so to speak? I think a big thing is spots like that on the river. You can't say like, oh, this pot's big enough for me, I'm going to check. Or, oh, what if I get check raised? I better just check. You're just throwing, there's a lot of money to be made on the river. And if you really think that you're having a hard time staying ahead of the games now, you just can't knowingly throw away money like that. Like you gotta get the most out of every spot.
Yeah, it's another example, as you were saying before, about people wanting to sidestep a tough decision. You know, rather than confronting a tough spot, they'll just sort of say like, well, the pot's pretty big, so I'm happy to take it down. And yeah, that I think that's just another example of sloppy thinking.
No, I think that's right. And I mean, sometimes like the bad result happens. Like I played a hand a couple of years ago where somebody bet the river and I made a thin value raise. Then he three bet bluff shove 250 big blinds on me and I folded the best hand.
hand.
That sucked, right? And then he showed it and he danced around or whatever. So first off, this is a chance for me to like build a godlike image, because like when that happens to you, you just got owned, right? And if you can just sit there and take it, then you win the psychological game, right? So
Tommy Angelo would be proud.
Yeah, so I lost a lot of money, but you know, I really cultivated the godlike image. And second, I can count on one hand the number of times anything remotely similar to that has happened to me in my life, counting liberally for times when I might not have seen the hand. You know, like if that happens to you like four times in however many hundred hours of playing 2-5 no limit, whatever, that's just going to happen. Like all the money I've made on thin value raises is a whole lot more than that, man. Six high nothing, I think. Yeah, it's just he really put in a lot of big blinds with that. He was not doing well against my range.
Strategy segment sponsored by Tournament Poker Edge. We've been talking about how important it is to think explicitly about learning and how the best poker videos are really focused on trying to get the viewer of the video actively thinking about certain things and working on certain things rather than just trying to passively absorb knowledge from the coach. I can tell you that those are things that I very much take into consideration when I'm producing poker videos, and I can't promise that every single video is going to be up to that standard, but I know that every single video on the site, that is, but I know that the owners of the site are real committed to the idea of trying to push forwards, just integrating things that are known about education and how people learn into the way videos are organized on the site, into the way that videos are produced. We actually even talked a bit about this with Derek, one of the owners of TP, when he was a guest on the show. But you know, if you're looking for a site where it's not simply committed to that bucket theory of education, where the instructors and the whole community is built around trying to make you an active learner in general, where the videos are set up in a way that you're encouraged to be working on specific skills while you're watching a video, and where there's a very active forum for you to post hands and get feedback on how well you're applying concepts, and to get constructive feedback, not just you play that hand bad fish, but you know, to really get constructive feedback on how well you're implementing concepts that you're learning from these videos. TournamentPokerEdge.com is a great place to sign up and find that sort of community and learning philosophy.
So this hand comes from
Dougs, who is an active member of the TPE community.
Here's to you, Dougs. is he our New Zealand listener?
Yeah, this is
one of our New Zealand listeners, or possibly the only
I believe
one?
It was.
Yes, we love this guy. There's somebody listening in New Zealand. That's awesome. This hand takes place during the Wellington Champs in New Zealand. Main villain is a good regular. He looks to be about 25, and he seems very comfortable playing with his chips and seems to know what he is doing. I hope that your view that he's a good regular does not just depend on the fact that he's good at playing with his chips, but I don't think that's what you think. In the first two orbits, he'd raise limpers with about 80% frequency and c-bet the flop. Hero has a starting stack of 15k, villain has 32k, and the small blind has 12k. Blinds are 25-50. Early position limps in. He's a habitual limper. Villain in middle position, this is the good young reg, raises to 225. The next guy calls, and then it's out to Hero on the button with king 10 offsuit, and again 15k. He says that I decide that this is both a good spot and a good position and a good hand to 3-bet with. So he 3-bets to 625. So it's limp for 50, good young regular makes it 225, call, and then Hero 3-bets the button to 625 with king 10 offsuit. What do you think of that?
I agree with all the things he says, that it's a good spot to raise. He has position. Being really deep here is a huge asset. I mean, you can imagine, even if villain has a hand as strong as like jacks, it's quite a difficult spot. I mean, if Hero 3-bets here, jacks really aren't good enough to, I don't think, to 4-bet. So, I mean, the villain is just going to have to call and play out of position with a hand that's very rarely going to be stronger than one pair, and there's still going to be a ton of money behind. I mean, the deeper you are, the more aggressively you can be playing your button, and this seems very clearly to me a spot where the villain does not have to have a strong hand. He's shown a real willingness to, maybe even an overzealousness in attacking limpers. So we don't have to give him a ton of credit for having raised to 225 against the limper. The person who called his raise almost surely doesn't have a premium hand. The hero is in position. I think it doesn't even matter that much the hero has king 10 offsuit, although it's certainly better than 8 deuce offsuit or something. I mean, although it is a hand that could be dominated, hero has position, which will help him to avoid the worst consequences of domination. It's not like he's just going to lose his stack if he flops top pair. And given that a lot of villains' calling range will probably consist of pocket pairs below a king, having one or two live over cards, of course, makes a huge difference to hero's equity. So I agree that it's a good spot. I agree that being in position makes a tremendous difference when you're this deep. I think the hand is certainly better than a random hand. I don't think the hand even matters that much. I think you can justify making this play with almost anything, certainly with anything that has remote post-flop playability.
Yeah, with a hand like king-queen, I might prefer just calling. I do think king-10 offsuit, where you're not loving the thought of just calling, I do like the selection of this hand to three.
That's true. I added his email, actually, and he did mention one of the reasons he liked three betting with it was that it wasn't quite good enough to call with, which I think is your point.
Like king 10 suited, I would again then just call, I think, but king 10 offsuit is, I think, a good three betting hand here.
The thing that I don't like is the size of the three bet. I think 625 is much too small for this situation, and there are a couple reasons for that. One is that I don't think there's any chance of you winning the pot pre-flop. That by itself is not the end of the world. If you're anticipating profitable post-flop spots, including like profitable continuation betting opportunity, it's really not that big of a deal if these guys are going to call and put 400 more into the pot and then fold a good amount of the time that you see bet. But I do think that you'd like to be putting more pressure on them with the size of your three bet. And you're so deep at this point that you actually want, even when you do have not the best hand, I think you still want to be putting more money in the pot just to give yourself room to access the entire stack. I know sometimes I talk about you want to keep the pot shallower when you're in position so that you have room to maneuver. Here, there's plenty of room. There's not a danger of bloating the pot, or we're very far from the point where we might be bloating the pot so large pre-flop that there's not going to be room to make meaningful decisions on all three streets. I mean, putting 625 into the pot out of a stack of 15k, even if you bump it up, like I think my preferred size here would be somewhere between 800 and 900, and I think bumping it up that much, you're still going to have room to bet all three streets and fold to a check raise on the river. So there's a lot of stack depth here, and the bigger that you can make the pot pre-flop, the more that you're going to be able to put pressure on your opponent post-flop. And what position means, I know we've said this many times on the show, what position means is that you make better decisions than your opponent. And the value of that is a function of how large the pot is. Making a better decision than your opponent in a pot of 1500 is better than and more profitable than making a better decision than your opponent in a pot of 1200. And this is true whether you're value betting, whether you're bluffing, whether you're bluff catching. You're going to do all of those things better than your opponent. And the larger the pot is, then your edge is going to be magnified. Your edge is a function of the size of the pot. And you'd like to be making a bigger pot here when you have a big hand. I mean, part of the reason you're three betting hands like this, in addition to the intrinsic value of just bluffing in this spot, is that you can you want to balance your range for times when you do have big hands. You hopefully will get more action in circumstances where you have a legitimately big pair here. And if you did have a hand like aces or kings, I think you'd want to be building a larger pot. So I agree with all the information, all of Hero's reasoning about why it's a good spot to three bet. I think it's an excellent spot to three bet, but I think it should be a larger three bet. I would probably go between 800 and 900.
825 was the number that came to my mind. Yeah, 625, if I'm doing the arithmetic correctly, it's exactly a half pot raise, and I think that's just too small, especially at this depth.
And I do think that your ability to play well is going to be substantially reduced if this pot goes multi-way. I think you'd really like to get a fold from at least one of the two people who have put 225 into the pot right now. Going heads up here is no problem. Going to the flop three ways just makes it a lot harder for you to do much. I mean, your options are just reduced in a three-way pot because it's just more likely that somebody has a strong hand that they're not going to let go of.
So Doug's three bets to 625. It gets called by the small blind. Surprise. The limper folds. The main villain calls the initial raiser, the good young regular. The other guy folds, and they go three-handed to the flop. So Doug's thinks that the small blind's range contains ace-king through king-10 and some other ace-x suited, and deuces through jacks, maybe even queens.
This may have been a bad edit of his email. This was not just based on the fact that she called a raise. He had some experience playing with this person. I kind of cut that out because it was a long email, but he's not pulling that range entirely out of his butt.
No, I think that's good. So, you know, some Broadways, some suited aces, some deuces three. I mean, it's loose, but well, it's a good example of a thoughtful range assignment.
I wanted to clarify that because I don't think it's what you, if some random just cold calls you out of the small blind here, I don't think you would necessarily want to put them on exactly this range. So I think this
ace four suited. Yeah, no, it's probably not. Pot's around 1900. The flop is king 7-6 rainbow. Small blind is a 35-year-old woman who's been playing many events and is loose passive.
That was the information that I thought I had cut out of the email, and apparently I just moved it to a less good place in the email.
Ooh, stick to blogging, buddy. Stick to blogging. No, kidding. They both check to Doug's on the button, and he elects to check behind since he thinks that the small blind will lead all better hands, and he can comfortably fold on the turn, and the main villain will probably stab at the pot with a decent frequency. I'm not saying that I would do the same thing as Doug's every time, but I love this reasoning, and I think that's really sharp and exactly the sort of thing that people should be thinking about more. Like, if you're checking the flop, you know, there are all the standard pot control reasons. You might get better value out of your hand, you might disguise your hand a little bit, all these things. But I love that he's thinking, oh, there are also these other spots where if I'm beaten, I can fold for zero more. And that's just great. So three cheers to Doug's here. I think I love this reasoning.
Yeah, I think it's worth considering, too, what he's representing by checking behind. And I think it, at least to a good hand reader, which the main villain in the hand probably is and the small blind probably is not, it's probably going to look like some kind of medium strength hand that has some showdown value, which is what it is. I mean, that king 10 does fall in that category. It's really not a monster hand here, where if there's a ton of action, as we mentioned pre-flop, king 10 could easily be dominated in the spot. So it's not a hand that here is eager to play a huge pot with. Nonetheless, I think even that range of medium showdowny type hands, and I would also exclude bluffs from here as range, because this is a pretty good flop for him to continuation bet. That's why I say I think villain is probably going to assume that Hero doesn't have a monster because he's not building the pot, but also that Hero doesn't have absolutely nothing, or else maybe he would have c-bet the flop. So probably the villain is going to put Hero in some kind of medium strength hand that's looking to get to showdown somewhat cheaply. That's a bit of a dangerous piece of information to reveal about your hand, but there are ways to do it in more or less balanced ways. So here, even if we know for sure that Hero has a medium strength hand, there's a big difference between how Hero is going to play king 10 and how he's going to play tens or jacks or queens, which are all also hands that Hero might, you know, or probably would 3-bet in this spot and then check the flop with. If villain doesn't know which of those Hero has and Hero's capable of having both, that's still a somewhat balanced range. There are things that Hero could be exploited by, in particular, you know, really big bets and overbets made with a balanced range of bluffs and hands stronger than king 10. But in general, I think this helps to protect him from the most common sorts of bluffs. Like it sounds like he says the villain he thinks might just like stab at the turn. And if he only ever checks jacks and queens here, that's a pretty tough spot to be in. If he also checks king 10, I think he has a lot more bluff catching value with that hand and maybe even can beat a few hands that villain might value bet.
Yeah, I do think that a hand like kings, I would discount as the villain because of the pre-flop raise size. Like, I'm not sure he would have made it just 625 with kings, but I do think that given this board texture, a lot of the reasons that make it good to c-bet, it makes it a pretty good, you know, a safe time to check top set, especially since there are going to be all these medium strength hands in your range. I might like to keep a powerful hand like three kings in my range also. So that should help making yourself too big a bluff target later if you're...
Yeah, although, you know, it's worth pointing out, not just based on the three bet size, but also based on combinatorics, there are going to be very few combos of pocket kings in your range relative to the king 10, queens, jacks.
That's right.
So, you know, ideally you could check a few other strong hands as well. I wouldn't really advocate checking pocket sixes or sevens. I think there's a good chance one of your opponents has a king and you want to start building a pot with a hand that big. I think the checking the kings makes more sense because probably a second best hand isn't out there. You've got so many of the kings accounted for. Yeah. But other good strong hands to check behind here, really any king I think would be a pretty reasonable check. Like ace king is not a hand that you want to be playing for probably for three streets in a three bet pot. I think like if you three bet ace king and then go bet, 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 and get called down all the way, there's a pretty good chance without any kind of history that you're not going to have the best hand. I think you're probably going to want to check one street at some point with ace king anyway. And I think both for the balance purposes and, you know, maybe just to get more value out of the hand, even checking a king as strong as ace king here would not be a bad idea. And that would certainly help to put more strong hands in your checking range.
Although even just the three combinations of kings, given that your checking behind range doesn't have just these like nines kinds of hands, some of them are five outers, even putting those three combinations combinations of kings in your range will ought to do some good. I think that your argument for checking ace king is a good one, but now I'm starting to worry about what your betting range looks like. If you start to put hands like ace king or king queen in your checking range, then given, especially given the raise size before the flop, then your betting range starts to get pretty weak. Are they going to do anything about that? I don't know, but theoretically at least, I think that's a problem. So it checks around. The turn is an offsuit deuce. King 7-6, then a deuce, Badoogie. Small blind checks. So that's a very informative check if Doug's read is right. And the villain bets 850 into around 1900. This looks like a straightforward calling spot. I can think of spots where I might raise, but I don't think folding is an option here against the villain as described. And I think calling is a good standard play. Is there anything I'm missing?
No, I don't see any reason to do anything other than call here.
And the small blind folds. And the river's a nine for king, 7-6, deuce, nine. Doug says, I think my perceived range for three betting preflop is something like queens or better. Maybe a little bit more than that, but okay.
Yeah, I found that pretty surprising, that line.
Especially like that sizing. I'm not sure that's right, but okay, that's what he says. And my checking black, the flop range looks almost exclusively like queens. Yeah, I don't know about that. You know, there's also...
I mean, if he thinks his preflop range is perceived as queens plus, then that makes more sense.
Therefore, his bet sizing for value should be quite small, less than the pot, maybe around half the pot. Before the river action, he has some smaller pairs he's turning into bluffs, some missed ace-x hands, ace-queen, ace-jack, ace-10, I don't know about ace-10, as well as hands that beat me like king-jack, king-queen, ace-king. Yeah, I'm not sure he calls all the time with a hand like ace-10. I also think that some people don't want to 4-bet with aces here sometimes, so I would put a few other combinations in there. I guess here he's mostly concerned to list the weaker and the medium strength hands.
You know, I do think it's good, though, that he's anticipating this kind of stuff for there's river action. I think it's a really good idea to think about, like, what am I expecting my opponent to do? There's no reason you can't think ahead about this decision. Only two things are really likely to happen. Either villain is going to check or he's going to bet. And so making your plan for what you're going to do in each of those cases is really something you can do as early as at least the turn, if not the flop. It was good that we saw on the flop, he anticipated likely turn scenarios. If the small blind bets, I can fold. If the middle position player bets, I can very comfortably call. He's already anticipating those things before he checks the flop, which is very good. And now before there's any river action, he's already thinking to himself, how do I expect my opponent to play the hands that are better than mine? How do I expect him to play hands that are worse than mine? It's a good insight, not guaranteed to be true, but quite possibly true of this player, that his value betting size on this river is not going to be huge. That if he value bets, he might target a relatively weak hand like queens if he chooses to do it.
Yeah, I do think that that's practically often correct, but I do want to say that as a matter of theory, that is incorrect. I've mentioned this before. When one person has the strong hands and the other person is bluff catching and the stacks are deep, the way to punish that, the way to exploit that is with big bets. The person with the strong hand makes more as the bet size goes up. And here I can just refer you to mathematics of poker. That's just how it works. I'm not saying that Doug's here is wrong to think that value betting will be smaller, but just as a matter of theory, probably villain's whole betting range here should be with bigger bets.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that's game theoretically true, or it's a function of optimal play. And I think a lot of people mistake a certain assumption. They don't realize that they're really talking about leveling or making an assumption about an exploitive thing their opponent is going to do when they say, I think he would size his value bets in a certain way, as though it's like obviously correct to value bet half pot with a king against pocket queens. You know, for all you know, villain expects that you're going to expect that, and he thinks that you're going to interpret a big bet as a bluff, and therefore he's going to make his big bets value bets. It's okay to get into that leveling game if you believe that you have an exploitable read on how your opponent is going to size his bets. I don't know whether this is what Doug's is doing here or not. It seems like actually he is, you know, doing this knowingly, but it is a mistake just to assume in a vacuum that this is the correct bet sizing or what your opponent is guaranteed to be thinking. You're making an assumption about what your opponent is thinking. You're also making an assumption that he doesn't expect you to expect him to be thinking that.
Yeah, I think for myself, I would probably bet something like 3,000 here with my value bets and my bluffs alike, and that includes like ace king. I would probably just bet a lot and let him bluff catch me. What would you do in villain spot? I mean, probably you wouldn't. You might 4-bet before. Well, maybe not. I mean, I don't think I would 4-bet before the flop with ace king. I don't know if you would. What would you do on the river here with ace king?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right that a big bet is called for. If I don't have some, like, maybe I have some read that Doug's here is a little on the scared money side or something, and he's just not going to bluff catch a big bet, in which case I might, you know, make big bets as bluffs and make smaller value bets. But if I didn't know anything about him, you know, I would want to default to the more optimal play, which is, you know, his hand is, I think, face up as a bluff catcher at this point. He didn't bet the flop, which indicates that he doesn't, and he didn't raise the turn, so he probably doesn't have a hand he's trying to play a big pot with, but he also didn't fold the turn, which indicates he has some showdown value. So his hand is pretty much face up as a bluff catcher. He realizes that as well, I think. Like, I would expect exactly what is going through Doug's head to be going through his head, which is that it's kind of clear that he has a hand like queens, or, you know, king 10, as we mentioned, is really not that different from queens. So it's kind of clear that he has a hand of that sort, and he probably realizes that it's clear to me. So I don't think that he would necessarily have to interpret a big bet on my part as strong. And so I'd be inclined to do it with both with my value bets. And also, if I chose to bluff here, I'd want to be putting maximum pressure on queens. I wouldn't want to make a bet that was very easy for him to call with a pair of queens.
And notice we say things like Doug's hand is face up here. I do think I've run into hands like aces. Like you'll see, you know, you make a nice big value bet and then you get called by aces or something. And it doesn't make any sense, but things happen that don't make sense sometimes. On the other hand, you're supposed to lose money to aces against ace king on a king high board and a three bet pot, so it's not that big a deal, I guess. But you know, so sometimes it'll happen, but I think you do much better with a bigger bet. I think there really are a lot of hands that Doug's can call you with. Good. So villain bets 3300 into 3600. Doug's thinks for a while, and he wants to think the sizing makes his range bluff heavier, but he's not sure. He thinks for a while, and he calls. Villain shows ace-queen suited and says, "Nice call with queens," which always makes me chuckle. And Doug's takes it down. Nice hand, Doug's. What do you think?
I think the only thing worth mentioning, I mean, one, this is a good example of how Hira's planning even before the river bet actually happened was probably helpful to him here, because I think what happens to a lot of people is suddenly if you're not anticipating what could happen and suddenly your opponent makes a big bet, then all of your other thinking could just sort of shut down, and the only thing you think about is, what does a big bet mean? Big bets often mean strong hands, therefore I should fold. And if you're not accessing all the information you have from the hand previously, like what is he putting me on, what pre-flop range do I expect him to have, if you're not thinking about all that sort of stuff, which I think is easier to do before you've seen the river action. Like once you see the action, I think you're just more and more likely to get biased or to focus too much on what actually happened. So I think that this is an example of Hira's planning paying off. And I also want to emphasize that I really don't want to encourage people to be like tanking for unreasonable amounts of time at the table. But even though Hira had a plan, and presumably his plan was going to be, I mean, he says that he thought villain would make a smaller value bet on the river if he were value betting. So presumably his plan was to call a big bet like this on the river. Even though he had a plan, I do think it's worth taking a few seconds to think about it, and in particular to look at your opponent when you're playing live poker. You know, if you're online, maybe you've already planned, you had a plan for big bet was coming, no new information is going to come to you. Maybe you can just snap call it online, and that can have, you know, a kind of a tilting effect on your opponent sometimes. But I think in live poker, it's worth taking a couple seconds in a big decision like this to double check all the information and the plan that you already had, to double check it against physical reads you might get from your opponent. And it would take something pretty strong, I think, to shift my opinion here, but I think it's worth looking, because every once in a while you'll pick up something from your opponent that causes you to say, well, maybe he has it after all.
I mostly just think this is a really well thought through hand by Doug's here. On every street, I just like how he was thinking. I think he had a good plan. I think he was considering the right things, and he made a reasonable decision. I think the flop check is the sort of play that a lot of people wouldn't get right. I think pre-flop people wouldn't have thought to three bet with that hand. I just, you know, and especially the river plan, I also think is very nice. So, you know, two thumbs up from me to Doug's here.
Well, I wanted to add it in on the flop check. I mean, it helps that this is a pretty dry board. I mean, there's the 6-7 for a couple of straight possibilities, but there's no flush draw out there. I actually don't think that's, I mean, it makes the check a little bit better, but I don't think that's a real important piece of why I like the flop check. With a hand of this sort, I would probably want to check even a flop, even if this was king 7-6 with a flush draw, I would still be looking to check the flop. So I think a lot of people are maybe more comfortable checking a hand like this when they're not too worried about draws. But with this much money behind, I mean, there's so much money in the stacks relative to what's in the pot, that your number one concern should not be, how can I make sure I win what's already in the pot? Your number one concern should be, how can I make sure I don't put too much of the, I mean, there's 2K in the pot, there's 14K in your stack. How can I make sure I'm not going to put too much of this 14K in bad? This should be more important to you than, how can I make sure I win the 2K that's out there? And I think that checking when you have a hand like King 10 is a very good start to that, towards that goal.
Can I just highlight one more time something you said about preflop? So villain actually showed up with ace-queen suited. Something good happened for Doug's this time. You know, this case turned out well for keeping ace queen suited in the pot, but wouldn't it have been nice to fold ace queen suited out before the flop? Or if not ace queen suited, then ace jack suited or a hand like that.
Yeah, or especially ace 10, which, as you mentioned, he might be folding to a three bet of this size anyway. But I mean, when you have king 10, it's actually more important to make him fold ace 10 than to make him fold ace jack or ace queen. And it's a more realistic goal. But I think it is the kind of thing where if he shows up here with ace 10, it's only because you gave him such good pot odds, not because he felt great about the hand versus your three bet.
I mean, I know it sounds a little funny here in this brave new 2013 world to talk about folding ace queen out before the flop.
Yeah, but I did think that was a little questionable.
Well, but if he's a solid young, you know, regular, and he's raising and gets three bet by somebody who's unknown to him, if it's for a reasonable size, like, it's actually very tricky to play against those ranges that are combinations of ranges where he might have a solid complete three betting range, or he might just have a totally nutted three betting range. It can be very tricky to play ace queen suited against those kinds of ranges. And I really wouldn't put it past him to just fold ace queen suited here sometimes. I don't even think that would be necessarily the worst play on his part.
No, I think it's kind of the other way around. I mean, I think it's probably a fold that more people should make. I mean, because again, it comes down to the stack depth issue. Like, even if you're pretty confident that ace queen is ahead of the three bettors range, or you're like, well, he could be pretty light here when he three bets, it's still really tough to combat that from out of position. Like, you might be better off just cutting your losses and saying, like, yeah, go ahead, take a small pot pre-flop. I mean, that's kind of the privilege of position, is, you know, even though you have a really strong hand like ace queen, it might be difficult for you to play it in this spot, and you might be better off rather than getting stubborn and saying, like, I have the best hand, damn it, I'm not folding, and then just, you know, getting yourself into deeper and deeper trouble as you face big bets on later streets. You may well just be better off cutting your losses and saying, like, well, congratulations, you have the button here, take 225 chips.
Yeah, and especially given that this is one of those ranges that's a superposition of ranges, if 15% of opponents have aces, kings, and ace king or something like that, or just aces and kings and queens or something when they make this three bet, that makes your life actually a lot harder with ace queen suited, even if the other 85% of people have, you know, bigger and more proper three betting ranges. So that's an important thing to keep in mind. But for 400 more chips, I'm not going anywhere with ace queen suited. So, and I don't think any villain is either. So, but yeah, really, really, really nice hand here by Doug's, I think.
Thank you for sending it to us.
Doing great. How are you guys doing?
Doing
excellent.
Well.
Glad you're here. I'm Andrew, by the way. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you as well. I've read your blog and been on your site quite a few times over the years.
Oh, wow. I'm flattered. I've been on your site as well.
How's it going, Nate?
Oh, it's going great. How are you?
Good. Long time no talk.
So you started a podcast, and I listened to the first episode of it, and I was shocked that you saved a huge reveal for the very end. I listened to 45 minutes of this podcast, and only then did I discover that this was the famous J_V. What caused you to make that narrative choice?
Maybe just because I don't think about Justin from his, like, 2+2 username. Wait. So did you know who he was from 2+2, or what's?
He's one of my favorite 2+2 posters of all time. I thought he was brilliant since, like, the very first days. I mean, he was just the best, especially if you cared about limit poker. He was just, everything he said was gold. I would search for everything he posted and read it all and study it.
It's really funny because I think I actually made a reference in that podcast saying how Justin's one of those types of people that I'll, like, go through his posts and just kind of see what he's posting about, because even if I don't care about, like, limit hold'em, I, like, kind of want to hear what his thought process is, you know?
So I guess if our listeners, I'm sure our listeners would be interested, you're starting a podcast about poker and business where you interview people who are transitioning into business from poker, roughly?
Yeah, kind of. And that was just the pilot podcast. The general idea, and I didn't even really know what it was going to be when we started, but I wanted to have a podcast that is about the poker industry, or is with people from the poker industry, but not talking about poker, really. And maybe if talking about poker, more like kind of stories and, like, more lighter stuff, than really trying to focus on, like, how you transition out of poker, or what you do with your money when you've made it playing poker. That's the rough concept. Justin was the first guy that I had on there, and he's transitioned into real estate and is doing quite well for himself. And then my next guest is going to be the former marketing director of Card Runners, Ezra Galston, who is just finishing up business school and has been working at a venture capital firm in Chicago for the last year or so, and is like going to fully go into VC once he graduates.
And he's a fucking A-plus human being. I love the guy.
So, yeah, Ezra's awesome. He's like one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. And really, really smart, too.
Yeah. So I guess for any listeners that don't know, Taylor figured out that you could 3-bet with plenty of hands like back in 2003. And he was really successful at poker, founded Card Runners, co-founded Card Runners, was successful at that, co-founded Draft Day. He's working on Bet Raise Full, the documentary with Krantz that you'll hear more about later. So he's one of the original guys to be very successful at online poker and to transition from that into business. You said something very interesting in your podcast with JV, which is that the startup life, at least for you and also for JV, is in some sense unsustainable. It's something you can only do for short bursts, and you could never have that kind of lifestyle for a long time. Could you say more about why that is?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would liken it to, if people listening are poker players, like when you first get started and you're sort of like totally immerse yourself in the game and all you want to do is play. And if you're not playing, you're like reading about hands or talking about poker, and you kind of like lose, at least for me and most people I know, you lose sight of what a normal life is like, you know, and you're not maybe socializing as much as you should be, or you're not keeping healthy or whatever. And I think I personally think to be successful at anything, you kind of have to take that mentality. And in my opinion, it's just unsustainable. Because you can keep doing it, but something else in your life is going to have to suffer. And in order to lead somewhat of a balanced life, can't be grinding it out, you know, 15 hours a day, every day.
So you don't think that's something uniquely bad about poker? I mean, that's a common criticism of poker, is that it consumes you. But you think that success in anything, not just poker, is like that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, unless you're like, I don't know, maybe a good example is like, if you're 7 feet tall and like super naturally athletic, you might be able to get to the NBA without like totally dedicating yourself to basketball. For the most part, those guys that are in the NBA are probably, that's all they do. And I think there's a lot of really smart people out there. And I think what just separates the successes from the non-successes are effort and luck. I don't think it's possible, yeah, without really, really dedicating yourself to something.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It's also useful for me because I'm at a startup now and I'm absolutely drunk on it and coming home and eating dinner with my wife and then trying to figure something out about databases after dinner just for the sake of what I'm doing at the startup. And it's, I haven't even thought about it ending really yet. And so it's something to hear that, you know, all this, you know, be listening to a podcast in the car on my way home and hear that Taylor thinks that this lifestyle isn't sustainable. We'll see if that's true.
So what are you doing at your startup?
We're Seven Bridges Genomics. We build a cloud platform for analyzing genetic data. So the idea is that you can upload your data to the cloud and then do all sorts of bioinformatics stuff with it there. And we have a really great engineering team. The product is amazing. It lets you run a lot of programs that there's no way to run right now.
Cool. Do you guys have customers and people using it now, or is it sort of still in development?
Yeah, yes and yes. I'm employee number 30 or so. So we're well that way. Okay. We're out of beta. We're up. We're as they say, scaling, which means that there's way more stuff to get done than there is people to do it. So sure. We're all scrambling all the time. I didn't even know I knew how to work with databases, but I guess I have to. So that's.
Well, I was thinking too, I mean, in addition to all the things you mentioned, Taylor, about needing to be dedicated and hardworking and maybe lucky as well. I mean, at least to found a startup, it seems like it also takes a lot of, I don't even know if courage is exactly the right word, but just the idea of starting something like Card Runners or Draft Day or something, and the number of movable parts it seems like have to come together, where you have to like find a guy to build the website and find a guy to do the payment processing, and I'm sure there's like a million other elements that I wouldn't even, I'm like overwhelmed just thinking about how much I would have to think about in order to get something like that off the ground. And I feel like it's more than simply effort. I mean, do you feel like it takes a certain type of personality just to wrap your head around a problem that big with that many pieces?
Yeah, kind of. I think, like, you're right, it takes more than effort. So the majority of people aren't even going to put in the effort. So that eliminates like a large percentage of people from even like kind of getting into that world. But from there, like, to me, I think what it takes is the ability to, maybe this is a too broad way of stating it, but like, I think people skills are extremely important. And when you're dealing with a startup, dealing with lots of different types of problems, and ultimately like, people are the ones that are solving the problems, and you have to kind of figure out, okay, who's going to do this? Who's going to do that? what can I do myself? You know, what can I pay for this? How can I get the money to pay for this? Most of those problems end up going back to like talking to other people and like figuring out a solution together that actually, you know, serves both parties. So for me, I think I've always been pretty good at that, just kind of getting along with people and, you know, trying to figure out something that's fair for everyone. And yeah, it's more than just, oh, you know, putting in the effort and working 18 hours a day. It's managing a lot of different decisions and coming to a good outcome. So I don't know if that's a good answer.
No, it is. And it seems like poker has been a useful thing for you to connect you to other like very smart people who, you know, now at least also have access to some capital. I mean, I guess for some people that's like going to Harvard or something is their means of connecting with those types of people. And it seems like maybe poker has been that for you.
Yeah, absolutely. At the very least, it got me started on that path. And I always tell this story. I didn't even really realize how naive I was. I'm sure I'm going to realize this at some point in the future, looking back now. But when I was in college, I took an internship at a hedge fund during the summer one year and met some extremely brilliant people that were successful beyond what I even realized was possible, were smarter than anyone I had met. And I really felt like I was the dumbest guy in the room. That to me opened up my eyes as far as what I could potentially achieve. So that was totally I got through poker. And then from there, you know, I met poker players that were really smart. And I just sort of, my eyes were opened and then I realized, wow, I need to start, you know, networking and meeting people. And now it's sort of through entrepreneurial circles, sometimes through poker, sometimes just, it's kind of snowballs. So poker definitely got it started for me. But now I try to look in and out of the poker world.
I wonder how important that naivete is also. I mean, do you think you would have started, I don't know if Card Runners even turned out to be a big project for you. But I mean, do you have the feeling that maybe if you had realized how big these projects were going to be, what you were getting into when you started, that maybe you wouldn't have started?
Well, Card Runners, I definitely would have started because it only cost us $10,000 to get started. And it was like,
it seemed like you actually were able to get Card Runners up and running without a whole lot of,
the reality with Card Runners is that when it started, it was just my business partner, Andrew Wiggins, and I posting videos. Yeah, it was called Card Runners, but it wasn't a community of people producing content. It was literally just us posting a video when we felt like it. So like, that wasn't really a big undertaking. The only reason it became a big project was because instantly the demand was there and we were like, oh wow, we probably should hire more people to do the same thing we're doing, and so on and so forth. So like, there's absolutely, I would have done it in a second because it just was such a no-brainer and frankly like right place at the right time. But you know, the draft day, I can't emphasize enough how much more work it's been than I thought it would be. And Andrew and I always like to joke that we used to make a ton of money and not do a whole lot of work, and now we do a whole lot of work and we don't make that much money. But it's really true. And I actually think draft day is going to be really, really successful. It's going to take a while probably, but the work that's gone into it since we started building it has been really unimaginable. I'd like to think I would do it again if I could, but it's just scary thinking about all that goes into it.
So another one of your projects these days is a documentary with Krantz. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, sure. So Jay and I are making a film about the story of online poker. It's called Bet Raise Fold. And it really aims to tell the true story of kind of what happened with the whole poker boom, starting from roughly when Chris Moneymaker won in 2003, taking us all the way to as close to present day as we can, and just kind of following around some professional poker players, showing people what their lives are like, and then, you know, kind of juxtaposing that against what happened in the business side of the industry and, you know, Black Friday and all the rest in between. So we're really excited about that. It's going to be coming out in the middle of June.
If I'm interested in it, where can I mean, I do want to see it. How will I be able to see it?
BetRaiseFoldMovie.com is the website. You can download it for, it's going to cost $10 when we post it. And then you can watch it, you know, DRM free streaming on your computer. And I believe we'll have some DVDs for sale at some point, but initially you could download it for $10.
From what I've seen of you and Jay talking about that movie on Twitter and elsewhere, that seems like an example of a project that turned out to be a lot bigger than you were anticipating when you started on it.
It was. Now, I'll be honest in that Jay is like far more involved in the day-to-day of everything. And he's like has a film background and is far more creative and like artsy, so to speak, than I am. So he's had to take on the brunt of all of that work. But it has been a lot bigger than we thought. And, you know, I definitely am glad I did it because, first of all, I really am passionate about the subject matter. But I also did learn that getting involved in a film or entertainment stuff for profit is like probably a bad idea unless you have really good connections and edge over everybody else. And I certainly don't.
How did you go about picking the people that you wanted to profile? Because I mean, I know you said you wanted to kind of show what the life of a professional online poker player is like, but I mean, that's obviously much bigger than one thing. And I mean, I know you ended up focusing on a couple of people, but it seems like there's, I don't know, like how did you decide like what parts of that experience or whose stories you wanted to tell?
Yeah, I mean, there was absolutely no exact science behind it. It was sort of, we wanted to, first of all, try to tell the real story roughly of, you know, we're not trying to show the guy who's making $2 million a year playing poker. Like, you know, not that that's not interesting, but that's not really realistic. We're trying to show more. We have, you know, one high stakes player, Martin Bradstreet, who's done quite well over the years. And then wanted to kind of show the spectrum of different types of professional players. So, you know, Danielle is a wife, a mom and a wife that lives in Minnesota, and you know, she's essentially a stay-at-home mom that makes her living playing online poker, or at least made her living playing online poker before Black Friday. And you know, we thought that was interesting, and we thought that there were some people outside of the online poker circles that might find that interesting, which was also important. You know, we didn't just want to make this movie for the few hundred thousand regular or a few hundred thousand real money online poker players or whatever the active number is, but we wanted it to be something that people outside of poker could kind of be like, wow, that's interesting. So we thought about doing like the D-gen type character that, you know, maybe was always like down on his luck. And, you know, we had some ideas. I forget actually who we had it.
Might be better if you don't have a name anyway.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't mean to like, I think I shouldn't say D-gen. I don't mean D-gen in like necessarily a bad way, just more in like a kind of up and down type of way, you know, and that's, there are a lot of guys like that, let's face it, in the poker world. But, you know, and then we thought about maybe someone that was like really grinding out small stakes, like looking for someone that might be playing, you know, 20 tables of, you know, small stakes cash games, just grinding out supernova lead, something like that, because that character is, you know, maybe that's like the stereotypical online poker player that people think of when they think of like the young poker generation. But ultimately, yeah, we decided on Danielle, Martin, and Tony Dunst, who is working for the World Poker Tour and, you know, has had success kind of traveling the circuit to some extent, and, you know, also plays online and just has like a kind of a mixture of interesting things going on.
And I know you started the movie before Black Friday, or before there was a lot of indication that something like that was going to happen, but did you have anything political in mind, like that you're trying to portray online poker in a certain light or to dispel certain misperceptions about online poker or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely we're definitely biased because we love online poker and we're biased. So yes, there was some, you know, motivation to show people that, wow, like there's kind of been some like crazy things that have gone on with, you know, the UIGEA and kind of the way some of the things were passed. That was on our minds, but we had no idea Black Friday was coming. And, you know, this movie was started, you know, roughly almost a year before Black Friday. So we couldn't have possibly predicted that. That's going to make the movie a lot more exciting, I think, when you see like this sort of like catastrophic event ripping through the industry. Yeah, ultimately, we think there's a lot of misconceptions about online poker in the general public, and we think this will shore some of those up.
What was the plan if that didn't happen? Like, what was there going to be any sort of like big dramatic moment or conflict or anything in the film prior to that?
I don't think so. I mean, it was, first of all, I'm not an expert on making a documentary, so let me just preface the statement with that. But ultimately, we wanted to just follow the characters that we knew were representative of online poker and then kind of see what happened. Maybe one of them would have a big tournament score. Maybe one of them would have a life event or something that's unrelated to poker. Then they have to try to, you know, deal with it. Like, I think that's just kind of like the nature of making a film like this, that you just, you study a subject matter, you follow it, and then you see what happens, and then you make it into a movie. So, you know, even if Black Friday didn't happen, the movie would be maybe a little more interesting or a little less interesting in that there wasn't that event. You know, it would focus on what the future looks like more. Like, it's a gray area. You know, we don't really know if the sites are going to be able to keep operating. And maybe the poker players are doing better, you know, financially, and that leads to more interesting scenes relating to that. I don't know. But we had no plan whatsoever. I'll be honest with that.
So here's something that I face that I think poker players also face in a slightly different way, which is that I do everything I need to get done and I work hard at, and I've got maybe 5 hours left in the week, and I can either, you know, get ahead with work, do other things, or else I can try to explicitly build up skills, either watch training videos for computer science, take online courses, you know, just work on my programming in a very general way, or not, you know, or I can do a more like applied kind of thing. And I think poker players deal with this too. I was always, I think I actually wasn't very good at this as a poker player, balancing working on theory with putting in more hands or something like that. Do you have any advice for people in that kind of spot? Like trying to balance between working on their skills in a more, like working on the fundamentals and more theory type development and working on the practice application side of things?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know if there is an answer to this question, like a right answer to the question. I've always been one that hasn't worked as much on like the theoretical side and instead has just tried to learn by doing and practical, you know, lessons, I guess, from doing stuff. So I think you have to balance that by having like a source of information and either like mentors or something that you're using to not just so you're like learning recklessly while you're out, you know, on the job. But for me, you know, like you, I spend the vast majority of my time just actually doing stuff for my job. So I don't have a lot of time to like just say, okay, I'm going to take 2 hours tonight and study something. For me, I find Twitter to be a great resource just because you can just connect yourself to really whatever you're interested in and you can turn it off. If you don't want to use it, you don't have to. I also hardly ever read books. I can't really remember the last full book I've read. I like reading internet articles and just shorter form like stuff, blogs and stuff like that instead of books because I just like to know the big picture with things. And I think that, yeah, I don't have the time necessarily to spend hours reading about one topic unless it's like very, very relevant. So that's that. I don't know what the answer is, but that's kind of the way that I do it as far as like learning new things.
Cool. Thanks. I also think the blog posts can be better than a lot of books for getting down to the details of things too, especially since things can move so fast and an expert can write with all the knowledge in the world at his fingertips as he's writing it. I actually think that sometimes books, for me, if I want to get the big picture of something, I might go read a book, but very often I'm looking for some detail or some very careful, fine-grained analysis of something, and that's what I think blogs are great for. I imagine you roughly agree with that. I imagine you get a lot of your detailed knowledge from blogs also.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like I said, I don't really read books, so I've got to get, if I'm learning from reading something, it's just coming from the internet. So I also think it's kind of, like you said, that information changes so fast and just the world we live in today does change so fast. So I can't really see how certain topics, yes, a book would be fine, would be suitable. But like realistically, every topic is evolving to some extent. And it, like I would prefer to be kind of just keeping tabs on the author that wrote the book and like following updates on via a blog or Twitter after I have the main idea of the book kind of understood.
Okay, so let's say I'm a poker player and I'm having a hard time. I'm being a poker player after Black Friday, but I'm a smart guy. I understand EV. I know some statistics. I'm willing to work at things. I'm willing to work a lot of hours and I want to get a stabler job. You know, suppose I never went to college. I just have the skills you get from poker and I'm a pretty sharp guy and a pretty quick study. If you were in that spot, what would you do?
Probably become religious or something. No, I don't know. I start hoping for good luck because I think in that situation, it's difficult. You don't have a degree. That's the thing that's shitty. Like I'm not one to say like a degree really matters all that much. The only thing that the degree matters to me for is that it signals that you're able to like get shit done and, you know, stay on task somewhat enough to get a degree from university. So, and that's important because a lot of people just can't get shit done. So if you don't have that, you might consider doing it. I don't even know what the state of online education is exactly. If there's like a good way to like, I'm pretty sure you can take a lot of community college classes online or like just enough to get like your associates cheaply and quickly and easily. You might do that and then maybe get the rest of it up, get a degree somewhere else. And in this, it's funny because I have never used my degree. So I don't think that like a degree is the be all end all. But if you don't have it and you're stuck, it's certainly like a good like transitional period to go back into something else because most of the rest of the world does kind of value it. If you don't want to do that, I would start networking like crazy. I mean, you have to find something that you're interested in, some general topic. Let's just say it was real estate because I'm just thinking about that podcast with Justin. Find a group, meet up with a group that's in your city or online that is involved in that topic. And, you know, I would personally get a resume and a cover letter or something and start just sending it to anybody that seems like they're smart and telling them that I'll work for you for free. I'll do all the grunt work and start just showing up at meetings and online communities and stuff and going about it that way. Because realistically, if you were trying to move on from poker, and essentially that means that you probably couldn't hack it in poker because you're probably not making a ton of money doing it unless you had already built up a ton of money, in which case you wouldn't really need to work right away anyway, then someone's probably going to be a little bit skeptical about, you know, taking a chance on you. So in that case, I don't know, you're in a tough spot, but you're going to have to start networking is what I would say.
Fair enough. That was a really good answer, but can I change it a little bit? You know, I've got 200K put away. I'm making 50K a year, but you know, the legal situation, yeah, I've got roots in the States and I'm not near a casino and I can't move. Poker is exciting for me, but I wouldn't mind a career change. And just for a lot of reasons, I'm looking for for a career change. But, you know, I'm a smart guy. I have a bachelor's degree. I've got some money in the bank. I could make 50K right now.
I feel like I should be the one asking this question.
What should Andrew do with his life right now? That's what I'm saying. What should...
Well, I'll tell Andrew the same thing I said on... there was actually a post on 2+2, like, not too long ago, where someone was saying that he was playing live. I think he was in, like, Atlantic City or something, and making, like, 50 bucks an hour, 40 or 50 bucks an hour doing it. And he put out a thoughtful post. So, like, I definitely believed that he was doing this well. And he said, what should I do? You know, I have like $500,000 in the bank. I'm trying to decide, you know, my next step. And my advice was to transition. It's not like binary. You know, you don't have to just like quit. I would play poker only during your best hour. So if your best hours are Friday and Saturday night or something, which they probably are at a casino, I would do that, or online, whatever your best hourly is, do that. But take half the time that you would have normally been playing and spend it on doing the same thing I said for the first guy. And that's, you know, networking, online communities, reading, you know, finding some subject that you can like be narrowly focused on. I mean, you can broadly focus on a lot of things to start, but then find something that you really want to investigate. Narrowly focus during your downtimes. Maybe your win rate goes, or your yearly earn goes from like 50K to like 20K or something, or 25K, and you spend, I don't know, a third to 50% of the time that you were before. And you're actually able to like kind of smoothly transition somewhat, because maybe in a year you've got an opportunity, or maybe you don't have an opportunity, and then you can just kind of keep paying some of the bills with online poker.
Yeah, maybe find an excuse to interview a bunch of smart, interesting people and see if they have any ideas.
Yeah, that's not a bad strategy.
And it seems like in part the podcast that you're starting now is maybe looking to answer those questions as one of its objectives, right? I mean, kind of looking at things poker players are doing to supplement poker or to move on from poker.
Absolutely. Or just to manage your finances while you're still in poker as a poker player. Yeah, I honestly wish I knew exactly what the podcast set out to do, but I feel like I have some good ideas, and I know a lot of people that might be willing to contribute. And yeah, it's just...
Yeah, I mean, it seems like one of the lessons of Black Friday is that even for people who maybe you're not anticipating that you're going to be moving on from poker or anything, that diversification is still important, that, you know, things can happen that you're not anticipating. And I mean, obviously Black Friday is what happened in the United States, but I mean, there are other sudden unexpected changes I feel like can happen anywhere. And that's true really regardless of what your career path is. And if you're too overly invested in poker, even if you do other things besides play poker, like you make training videos and you coach, but it's all still being invested in poker. And like, if something happens the way Black Friday did that drastically changes the poker market, that's going to throw you off. So if you're looking for new ways to invest your time, it seems like just trying to find something that's a little bit further removed from poker might be a wise idea, even if you're not anticipating stepping outside. It seems like at some point, if you're stable enough that you can afford to divert a little bit of time away from poker, it may make sense just to, you know, to try to build up a bit of a resume, even if it's volunteering somewhere. You're not necessarily, like, I mean, you mentioned, which is a good advice, just to, if there's a place where you're looking for a job or a person that you're interested in working for or working with, trying to start that relationship by doing some things for free. But I think also volunteering, whether it's at a school or a homeless shelter or an animal shelter, just, you know, some place where you can do something and make some connections. It's a pretty easy thing to do, just a couple hours a week to supplement poker that you're already playing. And it gives you something else that you can put on a resume to show, like, this is what I've been doing with my life for the last couple of years. Because I think from an employer's perspective, online poker probably looks pretty much like a black hole on a resume if you have nothing. You're just like, you've been doing nothing but playing poker for 5 years.
Yeah, it depends on the employer. My experience with people, they're like, they love it or they hate it. There's very few people that are indifferent to it. I 100% agree with that. And like, speaking to the poker industry specifically, even if things shake out well for online poker in the United States and it's regulated and there's like a thriving economy, I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that, you know, 10, 15 years from now, poker is going to be as lucrative of a endeavor as it is now. In fact, I think it's unlikely that it will be.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And I think, like, you know, with the way technology is going, you have to think that algorithms are going to get better and better, and that people are going to get better at, you know, basically cheating is going to be like, cheaters are going to get better, or call them cheaters, or call them, you know, people writing bots, or whatever it is, something is going to get better, harder on the technological side, that is going to potentially give more rewards to the guys that figure that out. And that's probably not going to be the same people that are already really good at poker today, or at least it's going to be a small percentage of them. And, you know, or maybe, you know, another big problem that I see with poker is that the great players are so good now, and like the skill gap between the new guy and the guy who's been playing for 10 years is so wide. So maybe that doesn't create a new crop of successful professional poker players like it did, you know, in our generation 10 years ago. And maybe poker just online poker just becomes kind of less of a cultural phenomenon. It already has become less of a cultural phenomenon, but I don't know. There's just a lot. I'm not too optimistic about poker as a profession, you know, 10 plus years down the line. Not at all.
I mean, especially because one wrong word in the tax code could already ruin it as a profession anyway. So, I mean, if you can't, for example, if you can't deduct losses for whatever reason, then you're done. I mean, you're just done. Like, so I live in Massachusetts, so I can't play online poker. I just can't. I can't deduct losses against wins. Boom. That's it. I'm done.
Yeah. I mean, that's so crazy. It's crazy that that's true, but that's just one example of lots of things out of our control that can totally change the game. And I guess like my biggest thing is when I look back to the boom that happened in like 10 years ago, it was a cultural phenomenon to where, you know, people thought it was cool to play online and like everybody had a party poker account. If you lose that, the cool factor and all the casual guys, the sharks don't have anybody to feed off of. And I just looking at how things change like culturally, and it just seems like a risk out there that to really stake your livelihood to the game. So no, I don't have like another answer of what you should be doing. So take this all with a grain of salt. But like, I just think that this all back to that discussion of kind of diversifying, it really makes a lot of sense to do it.
So you're trying to fill in the one thing you just touched on. You're trying to fill a big hole in the poker media world, talking about personal finance for poker players. I'm an ex-poker player. I have some money put away, not a ton, but you know, I have some money put away. I generally just buy and hold ETFs with very small fees. Like, so I'm not getting vigged to death. I invest in a Roth IRA. You know, what's the biggest mistake I'm probably making managing my finances? I'm just a vanilla buy and hold guy, efficient market hypothesis guy.
I mean, personally, I think that's exactly the way I would do it. And I do it for the most part. I mean, I think the only thing I add to that is trying to find random business opportunities, you know, like my friend Justin, who's doing really well with real estate, meeting a guy like that and knowing that guy can potentially lead to, you know, investment opportunities that are bigger and better than maybe just putting it in an ETF and letting it sit there. So I would say on the side, if you're trying, do everything you can within reason to build your network so that you can, you know, for lack of a better word, exploit it for better investment opportunities. Just my opinion.
Yeah. So we've had Russ Fox on the show, who I think is very good. He's a sort of the guy as far as being an accountant in the poker world goes. Is there an analogous guy for personal finance? Is there somebody, like, let's say there's a poker player out there who thinks he's not doing the right thing with his money. Is there somebody you can recommend?
Nope, not that okay. I know of. Yeah.
So listen to your podcast is the right recommendation.
Yeah, I'm honestly not even saying that I know the answer to that question. I think I know the answer to the question of how, you know, how do you go out there and find new opportunities and kind of like let randomness benefit you. You know, I think I'm really good at that. And that's things that I can speak to. And I think I know interesting people that'll probably have lessons that, you know, on the podcast, but I'm not like a financial whiz by any means. I just try to make logical, smart decisions and not try to do anything too complicated with my money. So I think, yeah, I'm not a financial whiz by any means.
Is that the way you think of it? Let randomness benefit you? Like that if you just make enough connections, like eventually one of them will pay off. Is that what you mean by that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what every, like, random shit happens every second, every day. And there's, you know, if you really formalize how you can expose yourself to as much of it as possible, it's really by taking like small little, I'll call them risks, but they're not really maybe risks in the true sense of the word, like going to a random networking group. For example, I kind of like this new, like, I don't know if you guys have heard of it. It's called Quantified Self. Like, it's a new movement where like you can actually, Nate, it's probably like, it's, I assume, is your company in this industry, the space?
I don't think so. But okay, is it like metrics for yourself? I mean, it's,
yeah. So yeah, I mean, like, whatever this, I don't, maybe there's some other name for it too, or other names, but like the idea being that like you can track data now that you never really could before, just because of technology and because everyone's got a phone on them and, you know, all the stuff that we all know about, you know, the way that like computers and phones and all that stuff is moving. But there's a real opportunity, whether it's in medicine or whether it's just in your like exercise or your eating habits or your sleeping habits or anything, to really log a lot of data about yourself. And I personally think that stuff's going to just evolve in ways we can't really even imagine. And so anyway, long story short, I just kind of like reading about it. I just bought one of the devices out there that can kind of help you log this stuff. I bought
you
one,
wear one
of those
wristbands.
Yeah, I bought the one. I think Fitbit is the name of the company, and there's a new one that doesn't look as. I don't want people to look at it and be like, "Oh, that guy's like tracking his data." I don't like the geek aspect of it as much as I do. Just so I bought one of those, and I joined like the Chicago Quantified Self like meetup group, and you know, I don't know where that's going to lead to, but I did it just because I think this stuff's cool, and I think it's actually going to go like I think it's going to be really big. And I don't know if something will lead to anything. I'm actually looking to meet people and make business opportunities. But that's something that's like low risk to me that I do stuff like that all the time. And I think eventually you find something big and then you roll with it. So that's my thought process, I guess.
Yeah. Anything else you want to tell people?
No, not really. I mean, I think it may be worth talking about draft day real quick, just in case people that are listening to the podcast hadn't heard of it, but basically, you know, draft day works in that if people that are fantasy sports players out there will know that a fantasy season lasts for an entire sporting season, and draft day's games actually break that down into one day. So instead of, you know, managing a team for like 4 months at a time, you can pick a lineup for that night and that's it. And you can wager legally on these games. So, you know, we accept credit card deposit, PayPal deposit. And it's, you know, it's pretty crazy, honestly, that this fantasy sports are kind of exempt from online gaming and poker's not. But that's the way that it is. So if you do like fantasy sports, I really do also believe this is going to be the future of that industry. And I hope that people will check it out.
How is it that that's legal? Is this like specifically carved out in a way that poker isn't?
Yeah, in the UIGA, there's a carve out for fantasy sports contests, given they adhere to like certain specifications, and also horse racing. So, you know, essentially the lobbies for horse racing and fantasy sports, which is the NFL, were very savvy in getting their interests protected when the poker lobby wasn't quite as successful at the time.
I thought the NFL was kind of like anti-gambling, or like officially anti-gambling, aren't they?
Yeah, definitely.
They're
on the
scared
record
as hell of gambling. Look at what they're doing in New Jersey. They're scared as hell that sports betting might be legal in New Jersey. Isn't that right?
Well, so you have to ask yourself, is what the NFL says publicly what the NFL actually thinks, or is that the right thing for them to say?
Well, no. I mean, I get that, but like it seems weird to me that they would because I mean, just to run a fantasy football team online would be legal anyway. It seems weird that they would try to carve out the part involving money if that's not something that they're going to be officially involved in.
Well, okay, so I can't speak to exactly what the NFL like thinks. I can only just make an observation. But if the NFL said that fantasy sports was not carved out of online gaming laws, meaning I have a fantasy sports, you know, team with my buddies on the internet and we're gambling on it, that's, well, I guess if the payments were offline, you could make the argument that you're not online gambling, even though your game is online. But anyway, I think they wanted to remove any sort of question from the fact that like playing a fantasy sports event is legal. They wanted there's also real money season long fantasy sports contests that are huge, that have like very large prize pools and that people, you know, that hardcore fans really like. I think the NFL loves gambling, sports gambling too.
Sure.
That's a huge reason why people watch the games. But it's also a really bad, you know, perception issue for the NFL. And there are some other reasons too that I've heard that I wish I could articulate a little better. But I think the bottom line being the NFL loves gambling. They love that it makes the games more exciting, but they don't want to be on the record about that. And they don't want any perception issues, negative perception issues. And they don't want, and they think that, you know, they want people to keep playing fantasy sports. So
you don't think they're actually fighting it, like hoping that it gets, want sports betting not to be legalized in New Jersey?
No, they don't want it to be legalized, but the reality is that people are going to bet, are still betting on it no matter what. And like they're wagering with their bookie or with their friends or offshore.
Yeah, if you're at the Borgata and you can't figure out how to place a sports bet, something's wrong with you.
And like I think that yes, they don't want it to be legal. Yeah, exactly. They want it to. They want people to keep betting on the games, but they want to say that they think that betting is bad.
All right. Well, I could talk to you about this all day, but we're out of time here, and we really, really appreciate you coming on the show, Taylor. Thanks so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, guys, for having me.
Yeah, good to meet you.
Likewise. Thank you.